This passage is a doozy, isn't it? Can we just say that? This passage is a doozy. Oh, no, I didn't mean for you to... Thank you. Okay, yes. You've got to be careful what you say into a microphone. Okay, so this passage is a doozy because it's got some really uncomfortable things in it. You've got this guy out of his mind, possessed by demons, running around a graveyard. I mean, this is how most horror stories start, right? Isn't this how the movies start, right before someone gets eaten? This is scary stuff. And yet, this has perplexed scholars for a long time, and it's often preached upon as though we're talking about actual demons. And so I want to just talk to you a little bit about what this story is and what this story isn't. First of all, the Bible is full of codes. Did you know that? It's full of codes. Oftentimes we call them metaphors or allegories, but they are codes to represent something that couldn't necessarily be talked about openly. For example, the book of Revelation is full of lots of scary images, lots and lots of scary images. But it was written at a time when Christians were being persecuted, and I mean truly persecuted. They were being arrested for no reason, tortured, and killed. So they had reason to be afraid. And when one of them, who was in jail, was writing to other churches outside of the jail, he wanted to tell them what was going on with the government and all about what they were going to do when the government was overthrown and how to hold out hope during all that time. But he couldn't talk about that openly. Do you understand that? Do you understand that if at that point the Roman Empire got hold of those documents, those letters talking about the overthrowing of the government and how the Roman Empire was going to crumble, how whoever was holding those would probably be arrested? So he wrote it in code. Instead of saying the Roman Empire, he's like the big beast with seven heads. You know, do you see that? So that anybody reading it wouldn't understand. It would just sound like crazy nonsense. So when we look, and the Bible's full of that, we see lots of those things, lots of symbolism of that sort in it. And in this particular passage, we see a lot of it, and I'm going to walk you through it. So first of all, this story takes place right after Jesus crosses the Sea of Galilee. Remember the story where he's in the boat and he's peacefully sleeping and there's this huge storm and the storm is rocking the boat and the disciples are all terrified. They're like, oh my gosh, we're going to be sunk. We're going to be overthrown. We're going to have a shipwreck. Save us, save us. And he wakes up and says, why are you worrying so much? And he calms the storms. Now, this is important because this is very similar to another story in the Old Testament, the story of Jonah. Remember Jonah and the whale? Remember Jonah being eaten by the whale? Okay, so Jonah was in the exact same situation. Jonah, God called Jonah to go do something, and he didn't want to. So instead he got on a boat, and the boat was in the middle of an enormous storm that was caused by God. And Jonah was sleeping while everybody else on the boat was panicking. And they finally wake him up, and they're like, we think you're the problem. Right? And he's got to get up, and they throw him off the boat. That's when he's eaten by the whale, and the storm calms. So then you see this similarity, and what's interesting about Jonah is he was called to go to Nineveh. Remember this? He was called to go to Nineveh, to prophesy to Nineveh, to tell them to turn around, to change their ways. Now, what's interesting about Nineveh is we know the name Nineveh. Nineveh was the capital city of Babylon, the biggest, baddest, meanest, most powerful nation on the planet at that point. So when we see Jesus on a very similar boat in a very similar situation crossing the Sea of Galilee to go to this Gerasenes, what we don't know until you look it up is that this was one of the biggest, most beautiful cities, crown, one of the jewels in the crown of the Roman Empire. It was not Rome, but it was pretty close. Do you see the parallel? So Jesus is now crossing the sea. Jonah had to walk into the capital city of Babylon and tell everybody to knock it off. It's a big job. It's a scary job, which is why he ran from it. So when we see this parallel story with Jesus crossing the sea, the same storm, him sleeping in the hull, and then crossing into this gigantic city, we know he's gonna say something important. Does that make sense? So that's setting the scene. He's not just casually wandering through and happens upon a demoniac. He is being sent, very similar to the way Jonah was being sent. Now, let's talk for a minute about what demons are and what demons are not. We hear a lot these days from fundamental Christianity about demons and about who's got them and where they are and what they're doing. And a lot of that comes from biblical stories like this. But as we know, oftentimes when we read through some of these stories, we recognize that ancient peoples may not have recognized things such as mental illness, such as schizophrenia, such as epilepsy, and so they just called it an evil spirit because they didn't have the same understanding of mental health and of physiology that we have today. So a lot of what we see in the Bible is often a very primitive understanding of health issues. Do we see that? Okay. This is another thing. This has happened to me several times before I was a minister and since I've been a minister, where someone would come to me, oftentimes a newcomer after they first come to the church, and we're talking, and I'll say, you know, we have a whole talk, we have coffee, and then I'll say, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about before we part? And at least six times, a woman has said, well, you know, I have a question. Do demons really exist, she'll say? Is that real? You know, can that really happen? Like demon possession, can that really happen? And they throw it out like it's this casual thing. You know, just hypothetically speaking. You know, could someone be walking down the street and be possessed by a demon? You know, like I'm having a latte and all of a sudden, whoops, wandered into one. So at one point I was having lunch with a newcomer and that question came out. Sitting in a restaurant and all of a sudden, boom, there it is. And I'll tell you, that's a really big and it's a very, very loaded question. So I said, you know, that's a good question, but let's go talk somewhere privately instead of in a crowded restaurant, because I think there's more to this. And they started to describe to me, you know, how they really did feel that there was something possessing them. There was something sort of evil spirit in their home and in them, and they were worried that it was going to get their children. It's very strange to have this kind of a conversation with somebody, but there it was. So we're going to go through what demons are and what they are not. So in this story, we see swine, we see demons, we see this guy hurting himself, we see words like cannot be restrained, and we see the fact that he's living among the tombs. Let's talk about what that actually means. First of all, there's a joke in this story. As heavy as it is, there's a joke. The fact that all of those demons are cast into swine is a joke. Here's the thing. The word legion is the name that they used to call a Roman regiment of soldiers. Right? That's what they called it. Right? These were the people that would inhabit the cities because the Roman Empire was so big and had conquered all of these lands. And they had to stay occupied, right? They had to have their soldiers on the ground so the population wouldn't revolt. And I think it was 100 or 1,000 soldiers was called a legion. And they terrorized the people. They would break into people's houses, they would arrest them for no reason, they would harass them on the street, and they generally made pests of themselves. Okay? I'm hearing mutterings. Are we seeing modern day equivalents? Okay. Right. So when he cast the legions into the swine, they were making the same derogatory statement that we have in modern day English as a slang word for police officers. Are we all with me here? When we call police officers, when someone calls a police officer a pig, they're making the same reference that we see here. So we see this guy filled with demons called Legion, that Jesus throws into pigs. Okay, he's making a commentary on Roman soldiers. Now, the other thing is, when we see that this guy cannot be restrained, no matter how many chains they put on him, he's strong enough, he can break out, that's superhuman strength. That's very much the Roman Empire. Anytime someone stood up to them, they would win. Nothing could restrain the empire at that point. And he's hurting himself. The demons are forcing the man to hurt himself. It says over and over again, he would bruise himself. He would hurt himself. Now, on the one hand, this sounds like mental illness. On the other hand, it sounds exactly like what the Roman occupation did to individual communities. Because it would destroy their culture, refuse to let them practice their culture and their religions the way they wanted to, but at the same time refuse to let them assimilate. It would encourage infighting and splitting within the community over very insignificant issues. While they were distracting them, they were exploiting them by extracting their finances, taxing them beyond reason, denying them job opportunities, They literally, you had to have a special patch that you could wear so that you could buy and sell in the marketplace. And only Roman citizens were allowed to have that. Other citizens, other peoples that were not Roman citizens were not allowed to have that. And the people in Jerusalem were not Roman citizens. And finally, they would set leaders above them that did not actually represent the people and did not have their best interests at heart. So when he says that the demons were possessing this man and forcing him to hurt himself, this is very much a commentary on what it looked like to have a Roman legion possessing a community. Does that make sense? Because it's hurting itself, and to a certain point it doesn't even realize how much it's hurting itself, even though it's being controlled by a larger power. And finally, he lives among the tombs. He has blood on his hands, if you will. He lives among the tombs. He lives among death. If you think about this as a horror story or as like a scary movie, it just sets the scene. If you think about how much exploitation and how many people had to die for the Roman Empire to become that big and to continue in its power, it had blood on its hands. That's how we would say it in modern day context. He lives among the tombs is how they said it in this story. It means his very life is dependent upon the exploitation and death of others. This is a heavy passage with this little joke at the end with the pigs. And when you look at how the demons behave, how the legion behaves, and how Jesus acts towards them, you see that it's not very, very demon-like. It says that he comes in, and the first thing he says is, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Not evil spirit, unclean spirit. Now, unclean is loaded language. Unclean is very loaded language because it reminds us of everything we hear in the Torah of what is clean and what is unclean, what you can eat and what you cannot eat. It's everything about following kosher law, which the Romans did not. They were Gentile. They were unclean. Does that make sense? He calls it an unclean spirit, not an evil spirit. And they beg not, it says specifically, they begged him not to send them out of the country. Did you hear that part? Let me read it to you again. And they begged him, let me find it. Oh, see, now I've lost it. Hold on a second. Okay. And he begged him eagerly not to send them out of the country. Hear that? They begged him eagerly. Does that sound like something you do if you're casting out demons? Send them out of the country, but then you're arguing about it? This was not about casting them out of the man. This was about casting the Roman soldiers out of the country that they were occupying. Okay? So, we have this focus on the unclean. We have this play on the words pigs. And then we have what comes down to the heart of the understanding of this passage. This isn't about possession. This isn't about demons. This is about the fact that the host, that this is Jesus pointing out a symbiotic relationship between the powerful and the powerless, recognizing that they cannot survive without a host to exploit because this is a parasitic relationship. And once he names that, once he points it out in front of other people, they beg him not to send them out of the country. They ask for the pigs because they cannot survive without someone to exploit. They don't know how. Does that make sense? Are we all still with me? Okay. So, this is a political passage. Jason Reed once said, "People who dismiss the unemployed and dependent as parasites fail to understand economics and parasitism. A successful parasite is one that is not recognized by its host, one that can make its host work for it without appearing as a burden. Such is the ruling class in a capitalist society." This is very similar to what Jesus was seeing at this point, where you had the ruling class exploiting the people. And the metaphor, this allegory of a demon possession, is how he saw it. So this woman and I exit the restaurant and find a quiet place to talk. And I just say to her, you know, sometimes when people ask about demon possession, usually it's women. It's because something happened in their past where they were sexually assaulted, usually as children. And because their child brain cannot process that, as they get older, they start to see it as an allegory very much like this. They don't even realize they're doing it, but they start to see it as a demon possession, that there's an evil force bigger than them with evil intent in their house, in their room, in their body. And this person, it all started coming out. Yes, that did in fact happen. Yes, it was still happening in the family elsewhere, but it was happening. Family reunion was coming up. This person had girl children and was going to have to go back into this family situation and was starting to have nightmares and worry about this and feeling like there was some sort of evil force in their room and in their home and that was going to take over them and their children. And they were frightened. And they couldn't process it, so they said, maybe there's a demon possession. I think I'll go ask a minister. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. And it's the same situation where you have a very, very large, very powerful force that is exploiting a much smaller, weaker force. So, what does Jesus teach us about what to do here? First of all, he names it. He says, get out, unclean spirit, which is a very simple phrase, but very powerful. On the one hand, he calls them out. You're an unclean spirit. You're not one of us. You're not part of the group. You don't follow the same rules that we follow. We're not the invaders here. You're the invader. We have every right to be here. You do not have the right to be here. And he names it. And he also says, come out. He doesn't ask them politely to leave. He doesn't ask them if they would feel willing to. He simply does not acknowledge their authority whatsoever. Come out. Just get out. None of this, you know, do you mind? Maybe we could submit it to the committee that would, you know, make an agenda item on the, you know, Roman Empire's calendar. Get out. He just names it. You do not belong here. We do not recognize your authority over us. You have no power over us. And this is really important because as we watch the way this has all come down, first of all, we see the awareness of the situation. We hear a description of how bad it is, how this person is living, all of the destruction that they're doing to themselves and to others, and that's acceptance. And then we move into the action, which is simply saying, you have no power over me, get out. So when we look at how the people react, they're very frightened. They're very frightened by the situation. The people that live in that city ask Jesus to leave because they're so frightened because they've never seen anyone stand up to the Roman government like that before. And Jesus is pretty successful until they capture him and crucify him, because when we stand up to power that big, it's very frightening to them because the reality is the power is not the way that we see it. It looks like the Roman government is this big and this powerful and the people are this small, but the reality is the people were this big because they all had their far-flung lands. They had their own people, they had their own cultures, they had their own cities, they had their own nations. The Roman government just had a small number of soldiers in each city to keep the peace. Does that make sense? But the reality was they were much fewer. There are much fewer. And so when Jesus points that out to everybody and shows that he has the ability to tell them to go away, it scares people because they know that any time you ask people who have enormous amounts of power to give it up, bad things usually happen. That's usually when we see things like riots, things like protests, things like police actions, and so on. So when we look at how Jesus teaches us to deal with these situations, and this is a very similar situation to what we have here. I was reading recently, there was an article about Berkeley Tech. Have you heard about Berkeley Tech Academy? Yeah, it's a high school for students that have been kicked out of just about every other high school in the area, usually because of behavior problems. And recently an article came out where five teachers, all under anonymity for fear of retaliation, talked about what's actually going on in there, how often there are fights, how often there are behavior problems, how frightened some of them are to go to school every day, how many students are. It sounds like it's just absolute chaos. And a school counselor, however, said, a school counselor suspected that approximately 90% of the students had complex post-traumatic stress disorder. 90%. Now, to people, ancient peoples, that might look like demons. If you see people that fly off the handle, scream and yell, and have violent tendencies for no reason whatsoever, that looks really scary to us. But she says, if they all have this, that's because they've had repeat exposure or daily exposure to extreme poverty, homelessness, harassment from police, drug addiction, domestic violence, or some combination of these factors that take place in a lot of our kids' lives. And when you look at what was happening in the Roman Empire at that time, that's parallel to this. They were going through the exact same thing. So, Jesus teaches us a better way. Where is the hope in all of this? If they could overcome this, if Jerusalem could survive, if the Jewish people could move forward, if they could find hope, and if the Roman Empire could finally fall, there is hope for us in this nation. Jesus teaches us a better way. First of all, he names the injustice where he sees it. He called it out. He looked it right in the eye and named it. That's telling the truth. He is not afraid to recognize how badly people are suffering and acknowledge it. That's compassion. He looks at what's happening in the community and calls people to look with different eyes. See it for what it really is. Recognize the power that you actually have and change what you're doing. If we all change what we're doing and move on a better path, we can overcome this. That's repentance. And finally, he's willing to take a stand and do something to challenge and change the unhealthy systems that were in place at that time. He was willing to actively do that and teach other people how to do that by standing up, by helping people where he needed to help people, by healing people where he needed to heal people, by feeding people where he needed to feed people, and by putting his money where his mouth is, by walking the walk hand in hand with others to make the world a better place. That's building the kingdom. And if we can do that, if we can tell the truth, if we can have compassion, if we can change what we're doing, and if we can actively help and serve wherever we can change the system and we can build the kingdom. And that gives me great hope. So the woman who came to me, when she realized what was happening in her own mind, everything changed for her. Just simply being aware of the connection changed everything. Simply recognizing that she was not this big anymore, she was a full-grown adult woman with responsibilities, with power, with capabilities that did not have to feel exploited anymore, made all the difference in the world. And she was able to take action to talk to her children about being safe. They had not been harmed, and she was not going to let them harm, to put safeguards around the situation, and to just not go to this gathering where there are harmful people, just to keep herself emotionally and physically safe. Just being aware made all the difference in the world, being able to see it. And after that, no more feelings of demons. Gone. Absolutely gone. Simply naming the truth, having compassion, changing what you're doing, and taking steps made all the difference in the world. And she had no more nightmares. Never. They never came back. That gives us great hope when we talk about demons, when we talk about casting out, when we talk about our fears, when we talk about our society. If the Roman government could handle it, could overcome, if this one woman could overcome, it gives us hope for the rest of us, doesn't it? Can I get an amen to that? Amen. Amen.